Today's Taisho will be on Case 41 in the Mumonkan, the Umenkwan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 41 is entitled Bodhidharma's Mind Pacifying. Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. The second ancestor stood in the snow. He cut off his arm and presented it to Bodhidharma, crying, "My mind has no peace yet. I beg you, Master, please pacify my mind. Bring me your mind, and I will pacify it for you," replied Bodhidharma. "I have searched for my mind, and I cannot take hold of it," said the second ancestor. "Now your mind is pacified," said Bodhidharma. Mumon's comment, that broken-toothed old Hindu, came so importantly, thousands of miles over the sea. This was raising waves where there was no wind. In his last years, he induced enlightenment in his disciple, who, to make matters worse, was defective in the six roots. Washasanro did not know four ideographs. Mumon's verse, coming east directly pointing, you entrusted the Dharma and trouble arose. The clamor of the monasteries is all because of you. This koan is one of the most famous scenes in Zen literature, you could say. When Daruma, Bodhidharma, left India, he went to China, and he brought what we now call Zen, or Chan. He had an opportunity to meet with the Emperor of China, Emperor Wu of Liang. And this was, many people would have thought of this as a great, great opportunity, because he was a very distinguished teacher of meditation in the Yogacara tradition. And Buddhism was already well established in China at this time. There were many different schools, and there were monasteries and nunneries going up all over China, libraries, pagodas, towers, beautiful towers. And there was a lot of Dharma activity, but no Zen. And Bodhidharma, Dhammo, came from India and brought this new tradition, this very rather different approach to Buddhism. And he had a chance to meet the emperor. And, you know, basically it was supposed to go like this. He was supposed to meet the emperor. The emperor was supposed to go, "Oh my gosh, you know, that is amazing. Your insight is so deep. Let me build a temple for you, a beautiful temple with lots of nice spacious rooms for the monks and nuns, and good food in the dining hall, and beautiful gardens, and you can practice there for thousands of years. You know, people can practice there for thousands of years." That was how it was supposed to go, but it didn't go that way. I don't know if you've ever had a job interview that didn't go well, but it was like a job interview that didn't go well. Bodhidharma presented himself to the emperor, who was a very nice guy, but they didn't understand each other. The emperor said, "What do you teach?" And Bodhidharma said, "Vast emptiness, vast emptiness." And the emperor said, "Vast emptiness, what's that all about?" And he said, "Listen, I've built many temples, many monasteries, I have endowed monks and nuns to practice all over China. How much merit have I acquired? And Bodhidharma said, no merit. So the emperor was shocked, a little shocked, and didn't know what to say. And after a while, they were just sitting there staring at each other, and Bodhidharma got up and left. And only later did the emperor realize what a remarkable person Bodhidharma was. And his attendant, who was a monk, said, he asked his attendant, who was a monk, who was that guy? And he said that was the embodiment of compassion. But it was too late. Bodhidharma was already gone and he wouldn't be back. So he went up into the mountains near what is now Shaolin Monastery. And he sat in a cave for 9 years facing a wall, practicing what is called Piquan, wall facing. If you wanted to, if you were trying to start up a business and you decided to go and sit in a cave for 9 years, that might not be a good business strategy. But that's how Bodhidharma decided to bring Zen to China. Now, you know, you could think of that as absolutely crazy. Absolutely crazy, right? I mean, if you want to spread your sect, if you want to spread your approach, you know, what you should do is write a book, you know, get on the Oprah show or television, radio, you know, and to be interviewed on your new book about the Zen approach. You know, that would be the way to promote yourself and your ideas. But Bodhidharma didn't do that. Instead, what he did was to sit in a cave for 9 years, perfecting his experience of awakened mind, honing himself, perfecting his experience of awakened mind, and swimming in the ocean of Mu, in the ocean of Mu. And one day, after 9 years, somebody shows up. Amazingly, somebody heard about this monk, who was this Indian monk who was living up in the mountains. People would bring this Indian monk food, bring it to the mouth of his cave. First second ancestor, as he is called, came to the mouth of the cave, begged Bodhidharma to make him his disciple. He said, please teach me. And Bodhidharma wouldn't do it. Basically, the second ancestor, the person called the second ancestor, sat outside in the snow, and Bodhidharma wouldn't let him in the cave. And finally, he cut off his arm to show that he was... He cut off his arm and presented it to Bodhidharma, saying, I can't find peace in my mind. And Bodhidharma said, show me your mind. And the monk said, I can't find it anywhere. And at that moment, his mind became completely at one with the world, completely at ease with the world. And that was the beginning of their relationship. So that's the famous scene in Zen iconography, Zen literature. You know, I work as an English teacher. I'm an English teacher in the English department at Rutgers. And I teach mostly freshmen. I hardly ever deal with graduate students. But recently, our department was rocked by a big scandal, a huge scandal, because we have a group of graduate students. We have about 20 graduate students. And we had an incident That has been in the newspapers. It caused a lot of embarrassment, even shame, to members of our department. Because, our graduate students are racially diverse, and it turns out that there was an event which was you could understand as racist. Some white students were going to have a party from which the black students were excluded. And at the party, everybody was going to eat watermelon and fried chicken. See, so this is like profoundly racist, right? And this is in an English department where people pride themselves on being very progressive, very forward-thinking. And the party never actually happened because as the planners of the party were planning it and sending out emails, word leaked out, especially to the students of color in our community. And then it just created like a massive explosion. A faculty got involved, and everybody was really shocked that our graduate students, whom we thought of as these wonderful people, could be harboring such unsavory sentiments. We thought of our department as like a beacon of light. And it's like inside of our department now, we find many of the same hatreds and fears that we see in the larger society. And we find them among our own protégés, right? So you can imagine how shocking this was for the people, the professors in my department. I have been giving this a lot of thought on and off the cushion. And I have asked myself, how can people who are who go to school in an English department and study things like racism and ethnic hatred and talk about it and have their professors lecture them on the problem, how can they still have that in their hearts after hearing lecture after lecture, reading book after book, How is that possible? And our department is really asking that question. How could we have produced such people, really? And the conflict among the graduate students has exploded too. There are factions and factions attacking each other. And not just racialized factions, but different groups. The atmosphere of mutual suspicion and anger is palpable. So-and-so isn't talking to so-and-so, so-and-so isn't talking to so-and-so. I've been doing a lot of sitting on this, and I've been doing a lot of thinking, and one thing that occurred to me when I was on the cushion was how we recruit and welcome new graduate students, Because what we do is we try to get the very best graduate students we can from around the country. And we go to places like Yale and Princeton, and we recruit graduate students. We actually sort of wine them and dine them. Yeah, this really happens. It's like we have colleagues who are in other universities, and we try to identify the best graduate students, and we say, encourage them to apply to Rutgers, and people take them out to dinner. And then before they come to Rutgers, before they accept Rutgers, usually these graduate students are so good that they have multiple possibilities, multiple offers. So, we might have some graduate students who have an offer from us, an offer from Duke, an offer from Yale, an offer from Stanford. And we bring all of our prospective graduate students to campus one day before they've made a decision, and we wine them and dine them. And we also, I hate to be crude about it, but we really kiss their asses, we tell them, you are so special, you are so wonderful, you know, please come here to Rutgers, you know. And we tell them, we're wonderful too, you know. So if you're wonderful and we're wonderful, think of how wonderful it's going to be. See? This is how we actually do it. And if we get the ones if we get our top candidates, you know, we feel really good about ourselves. And if Stanford steals them away, we are a little less happy, you know. So if we say we've got all 12, you know, we got all 12 of the entering class, you know, yeah, we got 3 Yales, a Duke, a Harvard, you know, we must be pretty good, you know. See, and I was going. I had to meet the chairman of my department, who I like very, very much, and who's a wonderful person. And I was leaving her office, and a graduate student was coming in, this new prospective graduate student. And my friend, who's a chairman, she became so, I don't know if you know this verb, fawning. It's like, how are you, my dear? You know, and so obsequious, right? Brown nosing, we say, you know. Now, you know, the thing is, this is really bad for human beings. It's really bad for human beings to be treated this way. It's bad for us to brown nose these people, and it's bad, very bad for them to be brown nosed. When I was sitting on the cushion and I could these scenes were playing in my mind, I remembered what happens if you, in traditional Zen, if you want to go to a Zen monastery and be accepted as a monk, they don't have a day where they try to recruit you. You know, you don't go to the monastery and it's like, here's the young potential monks. Oh, come in! You know, sushi? You know? Try it. It's really fresh, you know. Sake, you know, have some more, you know. Isn't this a beautiful temple? You know, let me take you around. You know, this is better than all the other temples, right? And we're going to say, you know, you're a really special person, you know. And we're special too. You know, we'd be a good match, don't you think? See, that's not what they do. Traditionally, if you wanted to be admitted as a monk or a nun in a training facility, you would go to a gate, like a little room for new prospects. And you knock at the door, and some monk comes and says, yes. You say, I'm here, I want to be a monk. Door closes, and you wait, right? And maybe the door slams in your face. Seriously, you know, and you wait. Now, you know, people know you're supposed to wait. But you wait, and you wait, and the day goes on, and it goes on, and then night comes, and somebody might bring you some dinner. See? And then the next day you think, okay, I've had enough, let me in. Next day you wait, right? Sooner or later, they'll let you in. But what they want to see is how you deal with this situation. And there's a kind of person who would say, well, this is crap. I'm out of here, right? You're keeping me waiting. You are keeping me waiting? No. I have Yale, Duke, and Harvard waiting for me, right? So we could have our graduate, you know, we should try this at Rutgers, right? We should have a day. We get them all together. We say, be there at 9:00. They show up, no coffee, no donuts. Nobody's there. Right? You know, around noon we could come in and say, you know, keep waiting. Somebody will be here soon, right? And then we could come in and say, listen, we're not sure we're going to let you into Rutgers. You know, we're not sure we're going to admit you to our program. How badly do you want it? Right? See? This is a Zen admissions procedure, right? Now, this is so good for people. it's so good for people to say, oh, the English department's approach is so bad. It's so bad. You know, you are special. You are wonderful. You know, we're wonderful. And what a great team. See, this is like a bribe, right? Bribe. You know, you're not making people free when you treat them that way. You know, you're not making them free. You're making them prisoners when you treat them that way. From the Zen way of thinking is they're already in illusion, and you're wrapping another layer of illusion tightly around them. So those graduate students aren't done any favors by being treated like that. And in fact, you know, they are all, you know, with all due respect, you know, there are exceptions, but, you know, because of the way they're socialized, they're all highly egotistical, fearful, anxious, competitive, and isolated people. And the system is designed to make them that way, right? I was reading something the other day that really shocked me. It's about American culture. It said that American culture has something called fractal inequality. It's fascinating, you know. Everybody knows now that one-tenth of 1% controls about 40% of all the wealth in the country. So the top minuscule slice of people control almost half of all the wealth in the United States, and the bottom 20% have almost nothing. They have the pants they wear and the shoes on their feet, you know, and they're one step away from being out on the street. So we all understand that there's this great inequality in our society. But these economists broke down the whole economic spectrum from Bill Gates and Warren Buffett down to homeless people. And they cut it up into tenths, right? Into this top tens, next ten, next ten, next ten, all the way down, so you get, you know, ten tens. And they found that at every level, people strive to be wealthier than their comrades, than their the people at the same level. In other words, everybody wants to be on top. Even the poor people want to be better than their fellow poor people. And this often takes the form of like consumption, conspicuous consumption. So the thing is, there's inequality from top to bottom, and at every level there's inequality. And people have inequality in their minds. It's what everybody wants to be better than everybody else. This is our culture. This is, from the Zen standpoint, this is really unhealthy. This is a really unhealthy way to live. You know, the United States is one of the most income unequal societies in the world, and in the industrial world, we're one of the most unequal in terms of rich and poor. At the other end of the spectrum is Japan. And even though Japan is becoming more like the United States, Japan is one of the most equal societies in the world, followed by like the Scandinavian countries. You know, the interesting thing is that if you look at Japan, you know, the Japanese have many problems. They're neurotic too. You know, but lowest crime, lowest mental illness, lowest. You know. Educational performance very high, you know. A different culture, you know. I studied not just Zen, but my second teacher, Webb Roshi, was the Ura Senkei tea master. And I was very uninterested in tea for a long time, in Chado, the way of tea, and then I got really interested in it. And I began to read all these books about tea ceremony, and I began to study the names for the different kinds of tea bowls. You know, there's a summer tea bowl and a winter tea bowl. There's different kinds of tea caddies, and there's different kinds of little bags that the tea caddies go in. There's different trays and all this very elaborate ritual. And I really took it seriously. I studied it like an intellectual project, trying to impress my teacher. And I went to see him and I said, I'd really like to study tea ceremony. And he said, okay, I'll teach you tea ceremony. And I thought he was going to say, okay, this is this whisk, this is that whisk, this is the winter bowl. This, and he said, no, let's just do a tea ceremony. And he said, the best introduction to tea ceremony is for me to make you a bowl of tea. And I was thinking, oh boy, he's going to make me a bowl of tea. So he made. There were actually a number of us together in the Zendo. This was after we had done Zazen. And to my left was a woman named Karen Friedlander, who was one of the members of our group and is a wonderful artist. She lives in Seattle, and her work is just magnificent. And at that time, she was studying paper, Japanese washi, paper making. Glenn Webb Roshi made this bowl of tea in this wonderful, elaborate ceremony where he brought a tray, he took the tea caddy out of the bag, he took the lid off the tea caddy, he cleaned the bowls with water from an iron skillet, iron kettle rather. He wiped the bowl. All this is meticulously done. And then he took the green powdered tea and put it into the bowl and added the hot water and whisked it up. And then he handed it to me. And I was going to drink it, and he went, don't drink it. Huh? And he said, you're supposed to put it down now and offer it to the person, offer it to Corinne. Offer it to Corinne. See, I gave it to you, but you're not supposed to take it. You're supposed to give it to Corinne. And so I offered it to Corinne. And she, in tea ceremony, the person you offer it to isn't really supposed to take it. They put their hands down on the ground, make a little like diamond shape with their hands, and they bow forward, and then you take it back, and now you can drink the tea. See, and my teacher said, always others before self. He says, that's the essence of chado. That's tea. Everything else is unimportant. See? Always others before the self. That's not just tea, that's Zen. So, when we welcome our graduate students at Rutgers and we say, you are so special, we are really corrupting these people. We're saying self before others, always self before others, see. And this creates a person who's like a prisoner of egotism, fear, craving, mostly fear, right? Because, of course, nobody can be that idealized person. We all know, in a certain sense, that nobody's really special. Nobody's really special. Special is a game we play. There's 7 billion human beings on Earth right now. 7 billion people on Earth. They get up in the morning, and some of them don't have enough to eat, and some of them get hit by cars. There was a woman named Maureen O'Halloran. I think that was her name. This was about 25 years ago. She was an Irish-American girl who went to Japan and became a student of a Zen master named Go Roshi. And she had just started practicing Zen, and in 2 years she had Daikensho. She had their great awakening, which usually takes 20 years, something like that. And her heart was so open, and her mind was so clear. She was able to practice wholeheartedly, we could say selflessly, really. just wholehearted practice. And she gave herself to this process and very quickly opened up in this magnificent way. And Go Roshi said, you know, this person is going to be the Dogen of our time. This woman is really has a great penetrating insight. And she trained with Go Roshi for a number of years, and then she went to Thailand on vacation and got hit by a car and died. And Go Roshi said, well, she'll be back, you know, in some way or another, you know, this will be back. You know, so, you know, we know in a certain sense that really good people don't get what they deserve every day, you know. And so, you know, in a way, special is an illusion, right? I am one of 8 billion human beings. You know, and actually, I'm pretty much like all the other 8 billion human beings, and so are you. And so, special is a kind of unhealthy mindset, an unhealthy aspiration. It's an unhealthy aspiration. When we sit down on the cushion, and we enter deep mushin, the self disappears. Dogen, the great Japanese master Dogen, said, to practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. See, this is, I think, quite important. You know, when a Zen aspirant, a young monk or nun, goes to a Zen temple and sits and waits for the door to open, you know, nothing happens, right? Nothing happens. This is so disappointing in life, right? We want to have something happen. So, you know, you go to the temple and you wait, and you wait, and you wait, and you wait. And the message is, you are not special. You know, not special. And finally the door opens and they say, okay, come on in, you know, please be in the Zendo at 4:30 in the morning. Okay. And you'll look like everybody else and you'll act like everybody else. This is forgetting the self. This is what Zen practice is all about. Buddhism is all about forgetting the self. To practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. So, you know, I say that the Zen method of welcoming prospective applicants is the superior method, because instead of helping people to, instead of encouraging the illusion of a special self, separate self, we're encouraging people to be free of that illusion. And by the way, when you're free of that illusion, you're really free. It's really quite beautiful. You know, sometimes when you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath, it doesn't go well. You know, you have 1,000 thoughts, your back aches, your legs hurt. You know, you can't free yourself from your fears and anxieties, from the tapes playing in your head. This happens to me, you know, quite regularly also. Sometimes, however, you know, all of that just gets blown away. Everything goes away, and there's this incredible openness in the moment. And you might not think, oh, there is this incredible openness. But you just feel this wonderful sense of, like, your burdens lifting. It's like all day long we're, like, carrying around with us a kind of cage that's getting smaller and smaller. And you can feel it sometimes. Sometimes you might not even feel like you can breathe. It's like the cage is getting tighter and tighter around us. You know, you sit down on the cushion, and sometimes it's like the cage is very tight. And you watch your breath, and you watch your breath, and you enter mushin, and then suddenly it's like the cage is gone. And it's unobstructed in all directions, and you can finally breathe freely. This is so precious. So precious. You know. This is a Buddhist freedom. This is Buddhist freedom. This is what Zen is all about. To practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And by the way, forgetting the self is beautiful. It's beautiful. We enter deep mushin, and at some point the cage dissolves and it's unobstructed in all directions. This is deliverance. This is liberation. Yes? Okay. But actually, the story does not stop there. You know, Dogen says to practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be one with all beings. To be one with all beings. In the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha says, you know, the illusion that I, the illusion is the belief in an isolated, he says, isolated individuality. An isolated individuality. The Buddha says that reality is actually like one great body. Like one great body. See, I sit down on the cushion, I watch my breath, my mind grows blank, and all the cage dissolves, right? And then, you know, I hear the fan overhead, and that sound, which is ordinarily so unimportant or uninspiring or whatever, negligible, suddenly that sound is so rich and full. It's a part of myself, you could say. You know, last night we came in this room and we did our zazen, and at the end of the evening we had tea and a date. It's the same every night, right? It's tea and a date, tea and a date, tea and a date. This has been going on for here in this room for 17 years. It used to be a Pepperidge Farm cookie. Or now even healthier, right? So it's tea and a date. And I had tea and I had the date and I thought, wow, this is so good. This is so delicious. Now it is good tea. It was Taiwanese tea, really excellent tea. And but it wasn't the Taiwanese tea is good. But what made it really good was forgetting the self. Because when I drank that tea, it was 100%. The universe was tea. The universe was that taste of tea. The universe was that taste of date. And at that moment, you know, that's one with all things. You know, we've all had this experience. You know, you're sitting at Sesshin. It's day three of Sesshin. Your legs hurt. You're tired. You know. And you hear like the wind, or you hear the rain on the roof, or you hear a bird singing, and it's as though the sound is coming out of your own body. You know, this is becoming one with all things. There's two sides to Buddhism, you could say. One side is emptiness. One side is emptiness. We say shunyata in Sanskrit. We say u in Chinese. Mu. Mu, mu, in Japanese, right? Mu, u, shunyata, emptiness, okay? When you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath, sooner or later you're going to notice that your mind is quite blank, really quite blank, no thoughtless state. And if you're really deeply absorbed in that, everything seems to disappear except your sense of hearing. And even that can disappear when you're in really deep concentration. And in that state, all the cages dissolve, and we feel boundless in all directions, right? This is like the formless realm. But, you know, this is only half of the practice, only half. The other half is experiencing the world as part of ourselves, right? Or experiencing the self as part of the world. Maybe I should put it that way. Experiencing the self as part of something larger, this big body, this great body. And that this is the word for emptiness in Sanskrit is shunyata, which means zero-ness. Shunya is zero. So the Buddha taught shunyata, zero-ness. But he also taught tat-ata. Tat-ata, which means, we say, is suchness or presentness. When you hear the bird and you feel that the sound of the bird is yourself, that's tat-ata. Tat-ata. When you taste the tea with an empty mind and you feel the tea, you feel yourself one with the tea, the universe becomes a taste of tea, that's tat-ata, tat-ata. The Buddha, people experienced the Buddha as very liberating. When people were around the Buddha, he inspired them to be better, you know, to wake up, to free themselves from the illusion of a separate self, and not be selfish, and not be self-centered, and to cultivate their mushin and experience everything as one body, right? This is very inspiring, apparently. Sometimes people would just sit with him for one time, and they would have a great awakening experience. People called him Tathagata. Tathagata means like, can be translated as thus gone, the one who no longer has a self, or is beyond the self, Tathagata. And it can also be translated as presentness, pure presence. So in his presence, people felt like the pure presentness of the moment. Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. The second ancestor stood in the snow. He cut off his arm and presented it to Bodhidharma, crying, "My mind has no peace yet. I can't find peace." You know, you don't have to cut off your arm, fortunately. But the point of this little story is that, you know, to be in the small self, to live in the small self, is a formula for unhappiness. You know, you will never be at peace in the small self. That's what this little story is really saying. Now look, we all have a small self, right? I get a check every 2 weeks, and it has my name on it. And if somebody tries to take my check, I will get upset, you know, because it's mine. It belongs to me. You know, it goes into my bank account. You know, if I come out to the parking lot and somebody's driven my car away, I'm going to be upset. I'm going to call the police. A few nights ago, somebody stole my wife's GPS out of her car in the driveway. They went in and they stole her GPS. I was upset, you know. I could get another GPS, but we had all our addresses on there and so on. So yes, you know, we all have a small self. And actually, you have to understand your small self, and you have to be kind to your small self. You know, you have to sort of know what your fears are and what your anxieties, where your anxieties are coming. And I think having a really thorough understanding of your small self is quite important. And has really, in some ways, that's really been neglected by Buddhist tradition. You know, so I think something like therapy is so good for people, because the therapist really helps you to understand your small self. You know, you realize what your anxieties are, what you're concealing from your small self, and so on. I think that's really healthy to be aware of the small self. But on the other hand, you know, the small self, at least in Buddhism, we think that the small self is unlikely to be as satisfying and fulfilling as the connected self. You know, the isolated self is, you know, sort of like always unhappy because it's always isolated. You know, we create that self by isolating ourselves, and then we feel isolated and unhappy. You know, so from the Buddhist standpoint, the small self is always going to be the Buddha said this is unsatisfactory, inherently unsatisfactory. Now, you know, you have to live your life as Bill or Bob or Kurt or Susan, you know, and you should enjoy your small self life. But the point is that it's never going to be entirely fulfilling because it's disconnected by its very nature. And so, you know, what makes Zen so special is that it's like we're missing half of the universe all the time. You know, we live in the modern world so much in the small self that we don't, we forget that connected self. And in socially, this is really killing us, in my opinion. You know, what happens to a society that overemphasizes the small self is you get no cooperation, cutthroat competition, social stratification, etc., etc. You get what we have. And so all people are afraid that society, you know, I go into Penn Station all the time. Occasionally I see somebody sleeping on the ground, and, you know, that makes me very unhappy for many reasons. But one of them is that I realize, you know, I could be sleeping on the ground too. Society doesn't really care if you sleep on the ground or not, right? And that's a message that has deep unconscious consequences. You know, we all go home with that memory in our minds, and we realize, if I fall, nobody's going to pick me up. See, that's a society that's not, in my opinion, not healthy, and it's based upon small self-consciousness. Yeah? So, there's this other consciousness, which is our connected consciousness. And when you're in that connected consciousness, compassion is flowing through you like a river. You know, it's like the mood of connected consciousness is compassion. That's the emotional character of connected consciousness. And I believe that if we have more of that other consciousness, we will have a stronger desire to take care of one another. I was reading, I mentioned this, I suppose I've told this story many times before, but I was reading I'm very interested in education, and I was reading a book about early childhood education in three societies. And it was Japan, Taiwan, and the United States. And they said that the Japanese kids, it was a Buddhist preschool, and they said this old monk took care of these kids, and actually the kids had a lot of freedom to do what they wanted and play, and there wasn't a lot of supervision. But the interesting thing was that they measured the three groups, American kids, Taiwanese kids, and Japanese kids, for their other-directed awareness. And like when all the kids were going out of the classroom out to play in the playground, all the Japanese kids were very interested in each other. And so they're all putting on their coats, and the Japanese kids would look around to make sure that all their fellow kids had their coats on and their hats on properly and were buttoned up so they wouldn't get sick. See, very other-directed children. As you might expect, you know how the story's going, right? United States kids, it's like, what other kids, right? Other kids? Oh, yeah, I hope they like me, right? Well, I hope they notice me, right? And the Taiwanese kids were in the middle, sort of halfway between the Japanese and the American models. Anyway, you know, what's happening in my department is really quite predictable. It's really karma, right? You know, you don't elicit what is best in yourself and in others when you live in the small self world. You know, a society that encourages that kind of behavior is going to be an unhappy place. And individuals who live that way are going to be unhappy individuals, unhappy, isolated individuals. Buddhism is, you know, in Buddhism there's three gems: Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. The Sangha is the we. It's the we, right? Not the me, but the we. Lately, I've been thinking Sangha is the most important thing. Right? What we can share as people is so important. You know, to be a we, to be a we, doesn't have to be this Sangha. You know, Sangha is like bigger than this Sangha. But the idea is that, you know, when we live our lives with others, for others, you know, we have a richer life than when we live our lives for ourselves. You know, my teacher was right. You know, this is the essence of tea ceremony. It's the essence of Zen. And I think it's the key to an art of living that really leads to happiness. Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. The second patriarch stood in the snow, second ancestor. He cut off his arm and presented it to Bodhidharma, crying, "My mind has no peace yet. I beg you, Master, please put my mind at ease." "Bring me your mind here and I will pacify it for you," replied Bodhidharma. "I have searched for my mind and I cannot take hold of it," said the second ancestor. Now you've had a little taste, Bodhidharma says, of this great body, which is the universe. Mumon's comment, that broken-toothed old Hindu came so importantly thousands of miles over the sea. This was raising waves where there was no wind. In his last years, he induced enlightenment in his disciple, who, to make matters worse, was defective in the six roots. Washasanro did not know four ideographs. So notice what Mumon's doing. Bodhidharma came from China. He came from India to China, and he brought Zen. And he had so much confidence in the universe that he sat for 9 years in a cave, convinced that everything was going to be okay. And a student shows up, and Bodhidharma teaches this student. Right? And he taught two other students, two men and a woman. And Zen comes out of those four people. The whole Zen tradition comes out of those four people and their interactions. So Zen transformed China. It's, I think, a wonderful thing. It had a huge effect on Japanese culture, Vietnamese culture. I think millions of people have wakened up through Zen, through Buddhism. But Mumon doesn't say, "Gosh, wasn't what, it's Zen, right?" He doesn't go, "God, that Bodhidharma, he was really special. See, he was really great." He says, "That broken-toothed old Hindu." See, he doesn't want to puff up even Bodhidharma's ego, right? He says, "I'm not going to corrupt Bodhidharma either." You know, by saying, "God, he was really special," you know. He says, "That broken-toothed old Hindu, he came here and made a big mess of everything." See, that's Zen style, a Zen pedagogy, right? It's like saying, "I might let you into the monastery, you just have to sit there for a few days," right? And it seems cruel, but it's not. It's the greatest kindness. Say, don't get attached to too attached to the small self. Mumon's verse, "Coming east, directly pointing, you entrusted the Dharma and the trouble arose. The clamor of the monasteries is all your fault," basically. In other words, all these people have wakened up because of your selfless efforts. Thank you. Thank you.